This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on June 29th, 2011. Tonight we're talking to Llewellyn Falco, and I watched a great two-hour talk that Llewellyn and Woody's Will gave this past weekend at SoCal Code Camp, in which they refactored a completely horrible legacy code, you know, worst-case example, into something that was actually, you know, kind of beautiful. And they did, along the way, they did it using approval tests. And it wasn't at all the focus of what you were talking about, but it really was cool. What caught my attention, Llewellyn, was that it was, the output was visual. Your output is, in that case, was pie charts and other kinds of charts. And you were testing along the way. Every 2 minutes, you reset a counter to make sure that you hadn't broken anything. And it was all visual output that you were testing. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in legacy code, it's very complicated to know if you're doing things right, even when you're using automated tools. So tests are a huge piece of production on top of that, or protection. On top of that, when you're presenting live, you know, that's as scary as it gets. So you really want that extra protection because, you know, we all make mistakes. And it's not that you're not going to make them, but you want them to be cheap.
I thought that was, you know, really innovative and beautiful that you were just right off the bat. That's obviously, like you're saying, the scariest thing about giving any kind of technical presentation is that you get, you know, 15 minutes into something, hit F5 and nothing works, and then you just don't know what went wrong. And so the way that you were doing your testing the whole way through was really cool. But before we go too deep into that, can you introduce yourself and let people know just, you know, what you're up to in addition to approval tests and how you got started with that?
Hi, I'm Llewellyn Falco. I'm a programmer. I love programming, so I do quite a lot of varied things in it. I'm the creator of Java Lambdas, which is a way to do lambdas in Java 1.6. I'm also the writer of the Coens for Rx. Rx actually just got released, the official version today.
Yep.
Coming out of Microsoft. I also do a lot of volunteer work with the site teachingkidsprogramming.com, where we go and teach 10-year-old through 17-year-old kids how to program. We kind of do that across the world. I also volunteer on a medical records project in Zambia, and I have an odd fetish for legacy code. But the topic of tonight is an open source project that I helped co-create, which is called Approval Tests.
So how did that get started?
I'd been testing for a while, and I'd always sort of, I was doing website stuff, right? And website stuff is notoriously hard to test. And what I ended up doing a lot of times was I would write sort of my web pages. And then I'd write a test that displayed the web page, and I'd actually like launch it in a browser and that kind of thing. And I would look at it until I got it right, right? Because I wanted that, like, is this actually working? And then once I got it right, I would like literally tell it not to launch. And my test was just, does it run without throwing an exception? And for years, that was as good as I knew how to do. And finally I said, you know, there has to be a better way to test this. And we used to do this thing where every Monday night, this was back when I lived in San Diego, me and my friends would get together on Monday night for 2 hours, and we'd program for fun. You know, it was called Monday Night Code. And just 2 hours once a week, we'd get together, we'd program on anything. It didn't matter. The only correlation was, or the only requirement was, it had to be fun. And we would just try stuff out. And that was remarkably both useful and educational, but also just, you know, help remind me of the joy of programming, which sometimes gets lost in the day-to-day of work.
You had a really cool post on that, by the way, where you were saying that, you know, just the act of doing that made the rest of your week fun as well. The rest, all the code, even what would normally be pretty mundane, was enjoyable just because you remembered that you enjoyed coding as an activity.
Yeah. Yeah, it's surprising. Cool. I mean, we all get into this out of love, and programming is a hard place to go if you don't actually enjoy the activity.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you lose sight of that sometimes. And that really helped to bring it back. And it was at one of those nights where, you know, we were just sort of like, well, let's try it, you know, and we did. And it turned out it worked.
So the idea then, how would you describe approval tests?
So when you're doing unit testing, there's a keyword that it will depend. If you're using regular TDD frameworks, it's usually called assert. And I think almost for all of the .NET frameworks, with possible exception of MSpec, is going to be called assert. And that's the way that you verify that you've got the right result. And it works really, really good if you have a string or an int or a Boolean. But if you have anything more complex than that, it doesn't work very well. And approvals is an alternative to assert. It's not a new framework or anything. You use it with your existing, if you're using MS Test or you're using MBUnit or NUnit or, you know, it doesn't matter. It's just a different way of doing an assert against a richer object.
So that kind of caught my attention because I'd been moving that direction anyways. I mean, obviously, like, there's been a move, or a lot of people, you know, started with testing down at the, you know, tiny micro level using unit tests everywhere. And then kind of I got bit by this on something I was doing recently where I really wished I was touching testing at a much kind of broader level and at a, you know, testing larger objects and larger output. And I'd been trying to move in that direction using the should library, which is kind of, it pulls out of XUnit and it's mm-hmm. kind of, you know, so it's a little bit more moving in the direction that I think you're talking about, but not there.
Definitely. I mean, BDD came out of this idea that, you know, sometimes you can get yourself in trouble by testing, I want to say, like, too much of your code. It's actually not too much of your code. It's too much of your implementation, right? If you test too much of the implementation, you can change the implementation and your code still works, but your tests fail. Mm-hmm. And so BDD sort of said, we need to test the appropriate level, the appropriate scope. And then they also said, you know, the language that you use is important, but they change the language, but it still maps one-to-one what you can do in that language as to what you could have done in the regular, you know, sort of X unit test framework. So they didn't really increase your vocabulary. They just changed the words.
Mm-hmm.
But they definitely wanted to start moving into that bigger scope. And that's definitely one of the things I find myself doing with approvals is moving towards BDD, which is, you know, let's look at the scope from the customer's perspective.
So when you're testing, I mean, I'll just throw out what I saw as my, you know, my experience when I tried installing it. So I downloaded some of the demos and I saw like some of the demo projects. I hit F5 and there's both there's an approved and there's a, oh man, I've forgotten already, like an output that said, here's what you, here it is, approved and received. And yes. So there was kind of a comparison. And at the beginning, none of those passed because the approved was blank and the received was the actual output of all the tests. And then I needed to go through, which would make sense. And I would say, here's what the approved output should be. And I saw a Visual Studio extension that let me mark those tests outputs and say, yes, what I got as received is approved. And then it copied them over.
Exactly. And I think that's the part of approval tests that I love the most, which is because, I mean, you don't have to now define what is okay up front. You just have to recognize it. And recognizing it is so much easier. And that's the sort of common sense part of humans that we're so good at and computers are so bad at. And before that, we never got to take advantage of our common sense, right? You had, like, if you wanted to define it, if you did like a whole sequence of math, you'd have to do all those calculations yourself, which is horrible. Like, we're mm-hmm. bad at calculations, but the computer's great at it. And you could look at it and check it and say, yeah, this is good. This is good. This is good. And that's the real power is that common sense that you have, like, you know, you can harness that. And that's something that I've really enjoyed.
So instead of, you know, the monkey work that you trying to act like a computer and saying, assert this, assert this, assert this, you let the computer say, okay, I ran your test. Here's the output. Is that correct? Exactly. And then I verify that it's correct. And then from then on, those tests just say nothing changed, really.
Yeah. And this hits one of the sort of important parts of approval tests, which is the reporter. And this comes from the realization that what you see in a test is really dependent on the state of the test, right? Like, I mean, you think it would be just as simple as if it's passing, you really don't want to see much. And if it's failing, you want to see quite a lot. And you see even like remnants of that in the assert. Like if you put a message on your asserts, that will only show up if the assert fails, right? It's not going to bug you with it if it passes.
Mm-hmm.
But there are even simpler things. Like, I mean, one of the things you said all the time when you run it in the beginning, it fails. Right. One of the things I notice in colleagues who do TDD but don't want to do approvals is a lot of times they'll write a test, they'll write the code for it, it will pass, and then they'll say, oh, we have to change something to see that it failed so that it's passing for real. And you don't get that with approval tests because you always get the chance to see what it produces the first time before you say that's okay.
And so the output, I mean, my first exposure to this, which was interesting, like I was saying, was it was a graphical output.
Well, in that case, we were testing WinForms.
Okay.
Right. We had this legacy code base of about, you know, 500 lines of WIN forms. And so we wrote about, you know, 10 lines of test. And because there's only like a couple things you could do with the WIN forms, right? You could show the pie chart. You could show the bar chart. You could show the pie chart small, the bar chart small. You could show neither, just the window that let you select. So that's five things. And so we just did those five things and then said, I want to verify that the form that's produced is correct. So we just pass it the form. It serializes that, in this case, to a PNG and says, this is what the form looks like. Are you okay with that? And when you say okay, as long as it doesn't change, we're good.
So do you get to a case where, I mean, a tiny, you know, one pixel off or something causes a problem? Or how do you handle that specifically for the image cases?
Right. So one of the things I found is like approvals allows me to, and not just me, but, you know, I pair program. So everything I say here is not actually me. It's me and someone else, and usually many someone else's. But we see that there's two parts of a test. There's the part where you do something, and there's the part where you verify it. And part of a big problem was verifying things, and that's gone away with approval tests. But doing something consistently can still be a problem. And so pixel off is not usually a problem, but what is a problem will be things like dates or random numbers or, you know, dates is actually, I think, the most common problem I have. And what you usually do is you set up a way to mock that or inject a date where you say, you know, instead of calling date.now, you call like a pointer to date.now, and then you pass in your own delegate that says, when you ask for the current date, I'm actually only going to give you, I'm a real big fan of March 14th because it's pi. So doing something consistently is a constant challenge.
Okay. So then how you're comparing those, I mean, I'm not sure, you know, trying to look inwards, if it's a different implementation. I know that there's a recommendation to use Tortoise Diff. Is that used internally or is that an extension?
This goes to the reporters. And reporters can actually be decorated at a couple different levels. You can decorate at the method level, the class level, and just recently at the assembly level. And so Tortoise Diff is a free diff tool. I tend to use Tortoise a lot. So I usually have it on my machine anyways, which is where it originally got written for. There's also stuff for Beyond Compare and WinDiff. And then there's other kinds of reporters, like a file launcher reporter. So like we have things like when we're doing RDLC testing, right? A lot of times we'll render those reports either in TIFFs, which are nice and easy to compare because you can use like an image diff from Tortoise, or PDF files. And PDF files are not easy to compare because there's just not good compare tools for there. So a lot of times I'll use like a file launcher tool.
Hmm.
In specific, if I'm doing something like I'm testing an ASP page, I will want to look at that almost schizophrenically between a diff reporter where I can say something changed, what changed? And it will take me directly to you added, you know, the table width is now 2 instead of 1. And the diff reporter is great at doing that. But then I also want to be able to see the web page because I can't parse and visualize HTML in my head at all. So I'll use the file launcher, which will just open it in, you know, Chrome or IE or whatever your browser of choice is. And I will flip between those two constantly, because I want to be able to see the different changes in what my code is producing.
So you can attach multiple reporters to one test then?
No, it's only one reporter for the failure, okay. But I'll run it, see it fail in a diff tool, and then switch it to a file launcher and run it again.
Okay. If you don't have Tortoise Diff installed, is there a way to hook it up with another diff tool of choice?
Absolutely. So it's an attribute on either the method, class, or assembly level, and it's called use reporter. And so you say use reporter, and you pass it type of whatever reporter you want, and it will use that reporter when it runs your test.
Okay. So the general flow, and like every podcast we do, we talk for a while, and then I realize the questions I should have talked about up front. The general flow is I write my test and then I say, so I set up some initial conditions and then I say approvals.approve and I give it an output. And then it creates a received file. And if there isn't already an approved file, it also creates a blank approved file and then diffs those. And if they're different, the test fails. And so my job then is to make sure that the approved file contains the right output. And then that's basically my flow from there. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I'm just going to break that down a little bit more concretely. So first, I mean, you just go to approval test, download the DLL. It's two DLLs for .NET. There's four different versions of approval tests for Ruby and for PHP and Java and .NET. And
actually, so, I want to call that out because a lot of that surprised me a little bit. A lot of frameworks and things that we look at are just .NET specific. And it's really interesting and cool that, this crosses so many different languages.
Yeah, and that really comes from pair programming. You know, I would never be able to be even capable or in domains, much less fluent, if it wasn't for, you know, being able to pair with other people who are fluent, who bring me into the language, show me how to get going. And it's really a testament to pair programming.
Okay. So, just to be clear, are these native re-implementations of the stuff in those target languages?
Yes.
Okay. So it's not just like shelling out to some program that's written in .NET.
No, it's actually brought across like another issue that I've tried to work on is how do you make sure that two implementations in different languages stay in sync? I don't have a really good answer for that. If any of your listeners do, I'd love suggestions. but you're going to go, you're going to grab the DLL. There's two DLLs. There's a utilities and there's an approval test. And you need both of them to test. But the utilities have things that you might want in your actual production code. Like there's a very simple logger in there that I found to be very helpful, especially in legacy code. And so you're going to include these two DLLs. And then what I do or what I find myself doing is I want to code something and I'm not quite sure. So I want to like draw it out on a piece of paper or a whiteboard. And so I go and I sort of get an example down of what I do. And for this, we'll just use like an example of an invoice, right? So, you know, like maybe I go and I buy a candy bar for $1 and I buy like a soda for $2. And I'll just sort of sketch, well, hey, I should have a candy bar for $1 and a soda for $2. And that should total $3. And then I have like 10% tax on that. And that's going to be a total of $3.10. Right? And so that like becomes my story, right? So I have that picture that I draw, sort of just sketch on paper. And then I go to my test and I write it. And I usually just write it in comments first. I'll be like, create a new invoice, buy candy for $1, buy soda for $2. You know, 10% tax. And then the thing I want to verify, right? That's all the do. The verify is I want to verify that receipt is correct. So I will just literally say like approvals.approve and pass it the receipt. And then I'll start programming. And every time I do even just a little bit, I'll just run my test again and it'll come up and it'll show me what I have. So in the beginning, right, it probably just has like, oh, there's a receipt. And then I'll be able to add like a candy bar to it. And it'll be like, oh, there's a candy bar. And then I'll add prices. And slowly this receipt will start to form. And this is usually just happening through a two-string, right? So I'll make like a decently well-formatted two-string. It's not going to line up or anything like that. But, you know, I want the information in a way that I can consume it. And then when I get it and it finally looks right and I have the items and I have the prices and I have the subtotals and I have the tax and the and I have everything and I like it, right? All this time it's opening up in a diff reporter. So I'll just right click the file and I'll say, you know, use entire file. And that will move it from the received to the approved. And then the test will pass from that point on, which is exactly what I want in my test. I want that sort of lighthouse spec that says this is where you need to go. As I'm going there, I want feedback really quickly that says, yes, you're on the right path. And then when I get there, I want it to say forever after it still works.
So is that automatic then? If it gets a string output, it stores a text file. And if it gets an image, it stores how does that mapping work?
So you can customize it. Approvals is actually very customizable. But there's a lot of overloads to approvals.approve. and sometimes in different folders because of the way that .NET forces you to bring in associated library. So we didn't want it like for the WinForms, we didn't want you to have to use WinForms if you're not using WinForms. So that would be in like the WinForms thing. Likewise, WPF. I mean, whoever uses WinForms and WPF at the same time, right? You usually choose one or the other. Same for stuff like the ASP code or HTML and XML, depending on where you are. So it'll be in there, but it's usually an override of approvals.approve, depending on what your namespace is. And depending on what the object is, it usually will figure out how is it going to serialize it. There's a couple specific, like explicit overrides. So there's one that will be like approved binary file that takes a byte array, so it doesn't confuse it with a string, which is also a byte array. There's some things like that, but most of the things are just approval.approve, and the type of object will change it. And one of those overrides that is particularly useful is if it's an enumerable of something, right? So you'll get this thing where it's like, I want to approve a list, And that's, again, one of those places. I mean, most of the times when I go to approval tests, it's because I wanted to test something, and then it became too complicated to test. And so then I'd be like, well, I'm not going to test that. Like, it's more work than it's worth. And, you know, a list is one of those things where good programmers in TDD, one of the things they've acquired as a skill is how to create that list so that it's easy to test with primitives. And I used to have that skill somewhat. But what I find is I actually have that skill worse now because I don't care. Give me a list of 20 things. I'm going to approve the list and it will just show me all 20 things and be like, this is the list you got. Is that what you want? And you're like, yes, that's sorted correctly or filtered correctly or, you know, whatever it is that you're doing to that collection.
So you're spending, you're not wasting any of that time of mapping your state to something your unit testing framework can understand. You're just serializing, and then the unit testing framework that you've written can just say, okay, great, here it is. And it really doesn't care at all what the format is as long as it can diff it.
Exactly. And even if it can't diff it, it's still okay. Because it can always tell if it's identical.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned like I'm not wasting any time. I'm really not wasting any time. I had a client once who they called me on Friday. And they needed it by Monday. I'm sure you guys have never had this, but I get this. And I looked at their spec and I was like, I'm not sure if I can even understand the spec by Monday. So I called the guy up and had him just explain it to me, take me through a scenario. And it ended up not being a very complicated thing. There were these CSV files that were coming in and they needed to be transformed to XML. And so he gave me a couple example CSV files. And even though he didn't understand XML a lot, we just used a visual XML and he had to just draw the tree. And since he's a business user, he understood that really well. So what I ended up with was like five CSV files that needed to be rendered or processed into a single XML file. And I mean, that's a simple test. You know, I made a thing, process CSV files. I passed it the five. It spit me out some XML. And then I said approvals.approve XML. But that XML page was huge. And so I then worked the entire weekend with that just one test. And, you know, at the very beginning, I got the first line working, and then I moved that over to the approval file, and I kept going for the other lines until I got all of the lines working. And that was the only test that I needed for the entire weekend of work. Yet I had granularity the entire way. So, I mean, I really spent almost no time on the test. And, you know, a lot of times people, when they talk about TDD, it's like I have one line of test for one line of code. I usually find my ratio is closer to like one line of test for every 60, 70 lines of code.
I noticed that both about, you know, the demo that you gave where you had, you know, starting with, I don't know, 500 lines and you had five tests. And then also the bowling scoring kata was same kind of thing where it gave you one test and said, don't write any other tests. Just, you know, work with this one and get it to work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that bowling kata, again, it goes to this idea of a testing circle. If you were to go to a bowling alley and pick up a player sheet off the floor, right, you would see sort of, you know, this is what I bowled and these are the scores. And then you turn that into code of saying, well, he rolled these balls. And then you write some code against it and it should produce, in this case, an output that says, you know, it's almost like a receipt of what you bowled. And that's your whole test. That's if you can do that on almost any random game you pick up, someone's going to have a strike. Someone's going to have a spare. You know, you're going to get sort of all the rules of bowling.
When it comes to testing some of these UI pieces that you're talking about, WPF and WinForms and web applications, I'm trying to picture sort of how that actually works. Is something automating the program?
So there's two parts, right? There's the do and the verify. And a lot of times, because of the way that stuff works, like Selenium being a good example of, it goes and it touches your UI like you're a person. And that's just horrible because it's hard to touch your UI like a person. You have to, you know, but we're not people. We're programmers. We're, you know, and when it comes to computers, we're like the gods of the computer. We can do anything. And so the idea that we have to go like through the front end and find pixels and push them is ridiculous. If you have a form and you want to hit submit, just expose the submit, you know, method and call it directly. If you want to like load up some value, if you want to load up a person value, you don't even have to fill up all the forms. Make a method that takes a person and populate your model that way. You know, so I don't go into the UI from the front door because there's no reason to. It just makes my life harder. But when I want to validate that it now is in the right state, then I render the UI. And that actually I find to be really, I mean, when I'm doing two strings, I have to think, how can I visualize this data so that it looks, you know, so I can consume it as a person? But with UI, someone is actually, and hopefully a professional, has actually spent time on, given a model or a view model or, you know, whatever framework you're using, how can I visualize this in a way that people can consume really easily? And so usually that's easier to test for me. The only thing I have to be careful of is to still remember to scope correctly, right? Just because I can approve the entire form might not be what I want to approve. I might only want to approve a panel on the form, or maybe I only want to approve the contents of a drop-down menu, right? Just because you can verify everything doesn't necessarily mean that you should.
So in the case of like ASP.NET, and specifically I was thinking about ASP.NET MVC, like I can have a controller. A lot of MVC tests are based on checking something about the controller output state. So I create a controller, I give it some initial conditions, and then I say, okay, you know, based on what I've given you, what is the controller output state? Is the idea that you either approval tests has some serializers that work with controllers, or I write my own kind of serialization logic, or, you know, what's the flow for an MVC application?
Well, if you're using MVC 3 with the Razor, you can actually output the HTML directly. And a lot of times I'll do that. I actually just figured out how to test ASP.NET projects today, just because I wasn't in a lot of ASP.NET projects, and I'm in one currently. And it's an odd kludgy hack, but it works quite elegantly, if those words can come together. What I actually do is I launch the website, the ASP.NET website, on the local machine. And the test is actually just one line. So, like, let's say I had a form called, like, medical report, right? And I wanted to test the medical report for the tuberculosis. I would put in my ASP page a method called test tuberculosis, right? And then in my test, I would actually say medical report dot test tuberculosis, but not the method. I wouldn't call it directly. I would pass the delegate to it. And then what happens is my approval test actually goes through the front door of the ASP website and says, call this web page and pass it this query, you know, test the medical report. And I have an interceptor that comes in on the load and says, if the query string starts with test, instead of doing what you would normally do, go and run that method. And so it runs that method, sends back the HTML, and it shows me the page. And just so again, I get to see the end result, but I don't have to go in through the front door. I don't have to touch the database. I don't have to do any things I'd normally have to do if I were to go into the front door of an ASP.NET website.
And that's only stuff that you'd have to do in a web forms application, right? Because in an MVC app, you can more cleanly just...
You can more cleanly mock out your model, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So are there any other kind of systems for, you know, other than kind of at a very high level, just saying test the entire output of this page or render the view to HTML? Are there any kind of serializers or anything that people have written for MVC apps that you know of? I mean, I'm kind of one track mind on that.
No, I understand. So for the MVC apps, I know someone who's written, so again, with the Razor, where it will pass out the HTML output. I'm not actually sure because I'm not in that world again. But I believe the way that he does it is he just passes again like the path. Okay. It goes through the router, comes in, grabs, but without launching the site, which is actually quite nice and fast.
Yeah.
And again, you just get the HTML output, which is again just nice. And again, you can set up your state of the model before you go in, so you can just bypass that part. For there's a couple other weird situations that pop up. I was doing this. This was actually from a Coding for Fun on a Monday night. We were trying the game Yahtzee.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're like, we got to this part in the test. We're like, well, we have to test that the scores are right. Right. And Yahtzee is a kind of interesting game, right? There's six dice that you roll and they have different scores. And six dice, it's a lot, but it's not a lot. It's just sort of, you know, it's a lot for humans. It's not a lot for computers. And so there's this thing in approvals called a combination approval where you can pass it a lambda. In this case, it would be like Yahtzee score, and it takes six dice, which in this case is 6 ints. And then you can pass it the parameters. So a range 1 to 6, 6 times. And it literally does all the combinations of that and shows you, I forgot what it was, but it was like 36,000 or something combinations of, you know, everything from 11111 would score this much to 66666 would score you this much, and just boom, threw them all out there before we had any code, right? So they're all blank at this point because I don't know how to score any of it. And then we went through and we'd be like, well, if they're all the same number, it should score this. So we'd fix that and it would pop it up again. And we'd see, like, you, with the diff tool, you can just skip, right? That's only six things, so it's pretty easy. You can skip through all 36,000 and be like, yeah, I got those right. And then you do the next one. And you could constantly test literally everything. And it's one line of code testing all 36,000 combinations. And
I thought that was really stuff. Yeah, I thought that was really slick because that, like you're saying, is a lot of the time coming up with all the different combinations of states is a pain in the neck. And just to be able to say, you figure it out. Again, you're the computer, you do the grunt work, and I'll just approve it. So I thought that was really slick. Like again, like you were doing, I think, in the bowling one and some other tests I saw where you just say, go ahead, figure out all the combinations for me and write them out, and then I'll approve the test.
Exactly. And this is the capturing of human intelligence. You know, we're good at verifying that. We're not good at producing it. Oh, there's another thing I wanted to talk about, which is legacy code.
Okay.
So you saw the thing, you know, obviously. I mean, I love what you can create in programming, but I also just love a good puzzle. And in my opinion, there is no better puzzles out there than what has been produced in legacy code and trying to clean that up. Like, that's some very challenging work. And, mm-hmm. and I enjoy that challenge. And so a lot of times I come into legacy code and there's no test on it at all. And in the beginning, I was like, oh, God, this is horrible. But what I found is it's actually not really that bad, because one of the gifts that legacy code gives you is that it usually runs, right? And so if you think of test in a do verify kind of way, you know, you can usually run legacy code. Now, you can't run it nicely. These aren't what anybody would consider good tests, right? But they are powerful tests. And so, I mean, to give like an example, I had a 10,000 line class on a project that I'm currently at, and it's responsible for creating these invoices, right? And it does it through a lot of SQL Server calls.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did is I cloned the database off of production so that we had something I could touch. But I didn't want to touch it even, right? Because I want this to be able to be reproducible. I always think in legacy code, I want to reduce my problem set to functional. Because if it's a functional problem where all the parameters come in, there are no side effects, and it's deterministic, and all the results come out, that's a really easy thing for me to test. I can just send in some permutations. Whatever comes out is obviously correct. I don't even have to look at it. I just approve it right away and just make sure it doesn't chain. And then I know I'm in a safe state. So what I did is I took my database and I set it to read only. And that forced it not to change. And then I ran my test and it would break, right? Because every time it wanted to change something in the database would complain. And so that helped me to find out all the places it wanted. And every place it was, I put a little logger and a little mock command that allowed me to just skip the actual command to the database from the test. So the test would come up and set a flag that said, skip all updates to the database. And when I was done, I was able to go through all 10,000 lines and record every change that it asked the database to do. And so that spit me out about, you know, 80 lines of SQL or 80 SQL commands. They're more than one line per command.
Yeah.
And I just approved that. And then I can start cleaning that 10,000 line function. And I had 100% test coverage, not from any knowledge. I'm still in the middle of cleaning this beast. I still don't really understand what it does. But I do know that even though it started at 10,000 lines, it's now down to 5,000 lines. I haven't broken anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's off of one test.
You know, this is funny. I think everyone, you learn more from your failures than your successes. And I worked on
Absolutely.
I worked on one project that was supposed to convert a power builder, all the alarm flags go off on this one. It was a very old working power builder app. We were converting it to Visual Basic 6. And nobody understood why it worked, and it just kind of did its thing. And then Power Builder is tricky because it can intermingle logic and SQL commands, and, you know, do things like, you know, set variable blah equal to select star from, you know, this and that. Really, really tough to figure out why it was doing what it was doing. And I worked on it for a while and it launched. And then later I talked to a developer after I left and they said they rolled back to the old version. And as you're describing this, I mean, that's exactly what I needed, was to run the thing through some, you know, positive and negative cases, get some real input and output verification and then write my code to work against those. And I think that would have had a, you know, that would have made the project a success.
Yeah, I've had really humbling experiences with legacy code. And fortunately, I have the test too, so it's my embarrassment is less public. but there was one where we were doing a conversion from just regular C code into C#. And it was only 1,000 lines of code. I mean, really, we looked at it and we're like, 1,000 lines of code, this isn't a big deal. And we transported it over. And we actually, we ran this exact comp idea on a log file. The log file was humongous. I think it produced about a 4 meg log file. But again, this is where your diff tools just shine. You know, I don't care if there's 3 megs of text I'm avoiding. The diff tool takes me exactly to like 3.1 megs where this line is now different with this character. And we had a butterfly effect where we had changed floats to doubles. And, you know, after many cycles of the calculation down, the rounding error was getting us. And, you know, it was a couple days in that we found this. And we had to go through and revert all our doubles back to floats to keep our rounding or precision correct. This was a medical, this was actually heparin. So, you know, like giving too much of it kills people. I mean, like, I was really grateful to have tests. Most of the time, you know, projects don't even make it into production. You can code all you want. But the medical ones scare me.
Well, so, you know, that does bring up something that I worried about. And I think as programmers, we obsess a little too much about efficiency. But I did worry about all these files being spit out into my test project, both the received and approved. So in that case, I mean, you're talking about megabyte-sized, you know, files. Is that something I should worry about, that I'm going to, you know, be filling up my project with, you know, gigabytes of test files?
Well, so in legacy code, my tests tend to be neither good nor fast. I don't want to say they're short-lived, because sometimes they really do stick around for a month or two. But I want the test there while I'm refactoring. And afterwards, I don't care as much, right? So there's this project, this is in PHP, which every day you guys work in .NET. You know, remember how blessed we are. So we have this huge, it's not even a method. It's just 6,000 lines of stuff. And we can't test it directly through the thing. We have to go through the front web server. And we start programming, and we write an approval test, right? So we go in, and we start changing it. And we're going along for a little bit of time. And then all of a sudden, something breaks. And, you know, me and my pair, we're looking at, we can't figure out what broke. So we just start undoing. And we undo, and we undo, and we just can't do it. Finally, we revert the entire code base. And it's still broken. And then we realize that the page is actually rendering based on the half hour, right? So what we ended up doing, and we did this for, you know, a day or two, we would, you know, it'd be 12:01, we'd create a new test, and then we'd program like mad till 12:25, and then we'd stop, and we'd wait till 12:31, and then we'd rerun the test, lock it down, and program until, you know, 12:55, and then we'd stop.
Well, that's, you know, that's a nice built-in Pomodoro exercise for you there.
Exactly. And that's the only way we could survive. So these tests don't necessarily have to survive a long time in legacy code. In new code, they tend to. But in new code, they tend to be fast. And they tend to be fast for a variety of different reasons, one of which is, if you think about the bowling test, right? Yeah, now it's writing to the file system, which is one thing. But you got to remember that the idea that your tests don't hit the file system is just a lie. Because where do you think that bytecode comes from? So whether you have the string, you know, in an external file that you're reading it from for verification, or an internal file, you're still reading the same string from disk. You're just paying that price at a slightly different time. And then on top of that, you know, we have this idea of do and verify. In Boolean, I have one do. But when people use, you know, just primitives to do it, what I find them doing is they have like 20 or 30 do's, one per aspect of the thing. But it's actually the same do. They're creating a game, they're bowling a couple things, and then they're like verifying a single part. And then they're doing the same bowling game. And if you think of it there, it could have been that one game, which is bowling, you know, something like 15 balls instead of bowling, you know, 3 or 4 balls per game. But I'm doing it once, and you could just use primitives against that exact same do. And we're starting to see some of that in BDD, where you have just the one scenario, and then you have all these shoulds against it, where you're sort of like, I just want to do this one thing and then verify it from different angles. So you end up doing less because you really only want to do this one thing and verify it. And so that really plays into the way the speed of the tests. And then something else happened over the last year or so, which is disks started going away. And the change to solid state drives also just massively speeds up my test. And so I think the answer to your question of like, are your tests performant? Are they fast? Yes. Usually I get test results back. And .NET, it's a little bit slower. It's usually in the range of like 5 to 8 seconds. But actually, a lot of that has nothing to do with my test, but the fact that just launching the test runner, even if you have just an empty test, for some reason takes a few seconds. Some combination of the actual launching and the way that it's doing the rebuild right before it goes.
You know, another thing I was wondering about is I've got these received and approved files in the root of my test project. Is there a clean way to say, I want all my receives to go in this folder and all my approves to, or should I just not care?
So not for the approves. When you run your test and they pass, they delete the receive file. So you should never be checking in a receive file. The existence of a receive file is telling you that your test failed.
Okay. And I want them to stay around so I can diff them, right?
Yeah, exactly. And of course, you want to pass the test. But the approved files do go into your source control. And this actually brings up like another weird and wonderful thing that we've discovered, which is, you know, sometimes like you will approve something incorrectly, right? So like, you know, a button will change color or something and you'll be like, I shouldn't have approved that, you know, or, you know, like the logo is now moving off the screen or, you know, it's concatenating a string too short. And you'll be like, damn, where did I introduce that mistake into my testing? And what we'll do is we'll just literally look at the approved file in source control and we'll just step back and be like, oh, this check-in, that's where that occurred. And that's really kind of a wonderful thing, is the intention of your test is much clearer in the approved file than it is in your code. And so it's a much easier thing to actually detect what's going on.
I think that makes sense to me, is that the approval state in your test, I mean, obviously that's kind of part of your test. It's normally putting those in the root of my test project. Is that
it puts them in the same file that your of your test is.
Okay.
So if you want to break those out, you have to break your test classes into different folders too.
Okay.
Which you can totally do.
And there's no, I'm guessing there's probably no way to configure it, and I'm guessing I shouldn't really care.
That's not entirely true, but let's say the configuration is more complicated. There is something called a namer, which will tell you where to do it. I've had people rewrite that, especially when they're working with JavaScript, where, you know, I need to put the receive file into a database or something. But as a general rule, you don't care.
Okay. So do you want to talk about any of those internals? There's namers,
Well, the reporters is the most important, right?
Okay.
In fact, there's one reporter that I haven't talked about at all for an interesting situation. A lot of times in my test, I don't want to go to a database. So there's actually a class called an iLoader, which is essentially just a funct of T, right? It produces something. And I do that a lot. So, you know, I'll have a little link statement that will give me all my customers. And I will wrap that in a loader of customers. And then I can pass in for my normal tests just some mock customers really, really easily, right? And that allows me to test like almost all of my code. But the one thing that wasn't getting tested was these loaders. You know, do they go to the database? Are they actually finding anything? And so one of the things we have now is called an iExecutable query. And it will take a loader. And so there's a default one in there for SQL loader. And what it does is, again, it's this recognition that when things fail, you care differently than when they pass. So what it does is it goes and it gets the SQL that would actually go against the database. And it says, you know, let's say just for argument's sake, it was select star from customer. And it approves that. And so if you said select star from customer, and last time you said select star from customer where name is Fred, it will fail, right? And when it fails, then it goes to the database. So I can run these against live production because I don't have to remember what it produced last time. It will take my new code and my old code, send both of them against production at the exact same time and say, this failed, they're different, and here's the results of them. And that's the reporter actually doing that, right? It's saying, and so when it passes, the database doesn't even have to be on. If it gave me the same SQL as it gave me last time, the database could be disconnected and that test will pass, and it passes really fast because, you know, if you don't go to the database, things
right.
are fast. And so the vast majority of those tests run almost instantaneously. And the only time they slow down is when I've broken my code or when I'm writing a new one. And so that's the reporter. It only gets called if your tests fail. It never gets called if your tests succeed. The other part is the writer. And that, again, is rarely changed. Although there are multiple writers that you'll sort of get by default. There's a writer that takes a WPF object and will serialize it to a PNG. There's a writer that takes like an RDLC and will serialize it to a TIFF. There's a writer that takes the WinForms, serializes it. And then most of the writers are actually just text writers. Like the XML writer isn't actually a writer. It's just before it sends it to the writer, it formats it for XML. So, you know, you get a nice, pretty, easily diffable thing as opposed to that nice one line of XML, which is just ungodly to read in a diff reporter. So the writers are really important. More importantly is just the overloads to the approval. But it always comes to the same line. It's just approvals.approve. Pass it the thing you want to be correct. And then when you see that it is, move it over.
Sorry, I think we have a question from K-Scott.
Well, I had a couple, but one would be how to add another reporter. So if you're working in, you know, something that's not covered by the XML or RDLC or any of that stuff, what would be the steps to take there?
So the steps are actually quite simple. You're going to create a new class, and you're going to say extends iApproval failure reporter. It's going to make a method that says, you know, report, and it takes the approve file and the receive file. And then you just add it as your user reporter and say, hey, I want to use my custom reporter. And when it fails, it will send you the file name of the receive file and the file name of the approve file. And you can do with that whatever you want to do with it.
Cool.
And then to backtrack just a little bit, I think this kind of goes to some of the philosophy of unit testing. But when you were talking about those scenarios where people are writing so many test cases that have the same setup code, you know, they're all doing the same thing, and then just verifying different aspects of a particular, you know, complex object, perhaps.
Yeah.
Do you think that in some ways is saying, you know, the old mantra about only one logical assertion per test, people tend to interpret that differently. Some people take that very literally and say, okay, I should only assert the score of the bowling object here, and I have to write another test to assert the frame count or something like that.
Yes.
Go ahead.
There is definitely a literal interpretation of that. There's also really the philosophy behind it, which is, I mean, tests give you four things. They give you the spec, and that's sort of the what am I doing. They give you the feedback, and that makes you faster because you know it's there. But you don't even need tests for that. You just need a main method for that. Then they give you that regression that things work. And then there's this fourth piece of granularity. When things break, tell me in a way that I don't have to search, that I know exactly what happened. And the idea of making very small, lots of little tests that test only one thing was a way to get that granularity. You know, so I could say this test broke and I know that it's my frame count that changed, or this test broke and I know it was the way it scores a strike. And one of the things I found is that just diff tools are so much better at that than lots of little tests, because the diff tool will come up and it'll be like, here's your whole score. This line is wrong. And on this line, this number is wrong. And so you get not only the forest, but you also get the trees. And that's just so helpful. You get you get that original sketch that you had to give you context of what's going on. And then you get the diff reporter literally taking you directly to the thing that has changed and what it used to be. And so that granularity is still there. It's just being achieved in a different way. And I'm a big believer in granularity. I'm just achieving it in a different way.
Good.
Well, there's two more things I wanted to talk about. So I mentioned at the beginning that I wrote this thing called the RX Cohens, which is basically like 56 little unit tests. You bring them in, they all run, but they all fail. And you go through each one, and there's a place where it's actually underscores, so it looks like a blank. And you have to change the underscore to get it to pass. And by the time that you've changed like 54 of those, you have actually a pretty wide and deep knowledge of RX. We're writing one of those for approval tests. They should be published by the weekend. And so if you're interested in learning it, it's a great way. You just download the project, open it up in Visual Studio, and you run your first test, and you know it's all sitting there working. You just have to change it a little bit to get it to pass.
Great. And that's in that would be at approvaltest.com?
That would be at approvaltest.com. It'll be Cohens, K-O-A-N-S.
Okay. You know, one other thing, just philosophy-wise, I was thinking about testing. A lot of the, generally, and you know, again, thinking more at the micro level with TDD, but I'll write some things that that pass and then some things that fail. And yes. So I'll say, you know, given the following conditions, this works, this works, this works. Given the following conditions, this fails, this fails, this fails. And that was one thing that kind of made me a little uneasy with approval tests was that, you know, I get the output state and I can approve it. And I guess I can write negative output state and approve a negative result, you know.
Yes.
And I
do.
Okay. So maybe I guess that's what I shouldn't be freaked out about that. That was something that threw me off a little bit was that I was kind of thinking like I need to write more like failing tests, you know, or tests for failure conditions.
And one of the things I found is as I started moving more and more into approvals, before I write those as like four or five different tests, now I will make an array of my parameters and just say approve the array of parameters, and then I'll pass a lambda that actually does the do part. And so, and because I can just give it like a list, right? Like I was doing a little kata the other day where you had to turn numbers into English numbers, right? And so that test ended up being one test. It was, I made an integer array, and then I said approve the array in a lambda that pointed it to the two English numbers. And then I just put in like 1, 2, 10, 11, 22, 101, you know, 1,000, 1,001, 1,100, 1,105. And I ended up with just sort of a list of about, you know, 30 numbers at the end because it's going up to about a million and get some weird English stuff that occurs up there.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gave me, a list of those numbers, one per line saying this number goes to this word in English. And, you know, I added those cases one at a time as I got more and more complex. But in the end, it was still just one unit test, two lines of code. And I'm able to test more negative cases that way because I can just throw five negative cases in there. I don't have to write five more tests. And again, because that bar gets lower, I find my discipline goes up. I'm not sure if it's actually called discipline when it's easy, but you know, the end result is the same.
Right. So going back to the case of that you don't need to write a bunch of separate tests because you've got the granularity presented to you a different way.
Exactly. And that, you know, every time that I find myself or a different programmer and they're like, I don't know how to write this test, so I'm not going to, that's usually when I recommend approval tests. Go take a look at there because that makes it easy to write it.
Okay. So you mentioned all these different languages earlier, and one that came to mind, I don't know if you've heard of Atwood's Law, but it's that, you know, anything will be written in JavaScript eventually.
Yeah.
I wondered if anyone's looked at writing, or you specifically have looked at writing approval tests in JavaScript or Fortran.
So I mentioned before that, yes, I had someone who wrote it in JavaScript, but they didn't publish it open source. They were the ones who were using it. They were using JavaScript to pull out the results to the database, but they didn't publish it. So unfortunately, I don't think there's a published version of JavaScript, but I'm sure there will be because that law is absolutely true.
Yep. More now than ever. So what are some things going forward? What are some things that you're looking at doing?
So we're looking at making the stuff that we've been doing internally because it's so easy to customize for stuff like the RDLC reports. We've gotten that down so that you can literally pass an RDLC report and a data set. It will populate the data set with fake data using reflection and create your RDLC report as a TIFF and show it to you. So it's like one line. Here's the string of my report. Here's the data set. Go for it.
And for listeners that haven't done this, RDLC, it's been a little bit for me. I think that's SQL Server reports, right? Reporting
services? It is SQL. It's reporting services, yeah.
Okay, cool. I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, absolutely. So those things we're looking at getting from, you know, more customer stuff right into the API. So it's there. Also, one of the things that we've been working on is the Visual Studio plugin, which is very, very sparse right now. But we wanted to do easier things, tell you exactly if your tests have passed or failed last time you wrote them, give you the ability to easily launch the files and that kind of stuff. So those kind of things you should see coming out actually in the next month or so.
Cool. And you know that it took me a little digging around. I pinged you offline about this, but about that Visual Studio thing. So you right click on a test on an approval test, you right click and you get a new context menu item that says approve. Is that how you use it?
That's it. And it's really simple. All it does is move it over.
It's great though. I mean, that's all you need.
a lot of times, even though I wrote it for myself, I end up just using the right click on the diff reporter. So I really want the richer functionality. The CodeRush plugin that we wrote for 2008 had a lot more functionality, and just haven't gotten around to porting it over to 2010.
So what does the CodeRush plugin do in addition?
So one thing it will do is it will underline your approval line yellow if you've never run it before, which it can tell because there's neither an approved or a received file. Like a dark red if you've run it, but you've never approved it. So it's never been said this is okay. Green if you've run it and approved it, which means there's only an approval file. And then a bright red if you've run it and the approval or the receive file has now changed and passed. It also gives you the ability to open the received and the approved files just from there, which, you know, I'll do a lot of times with the customer. I'll open up the receive file of a form when they want to change it. And I'll literally let them draw and paint what, you know, just mark up in red what you want changed. And then my test will fail, and I'll work on it until it passes, and then I'll just approve the new pass. They can literally change their requirements directly in my tests.
Wow. So that brings to mind, you know, the whole idea of coverage. Is there something that, you know, how do I get an idea of coverage based on these kind of, you know, broad approval tests?
So first of all, I find I use coverage very heavily in legacy projects, where I don't use them hardly at all in new projects. Because you're writing new code, you're writing test-driven, you know that your code is well covered.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like the visual aspect in legacy code. It lets me see what's going on. There's a couple things. First of all, I use the regular coverage things. I use doc cover a lot because I just really like the way that it works. Also, I have a copy of Ultimate Studio. So Visual Studio Ultimate has a code coverage tool in it. Both of them work. And so I'll just run it with coverage so I can see what is there. One of the things that you get with approval tests, especially in legacy code, is high coverage very quickly. And you get it in a couple different ways. One is that you're taking these very wide, long paths through your code because nothing's broken up to let you just test a single unit. Almost anything you test, you're going to go like through a database and back, and you know everything you're not supposed to do in testing. But it's the only thing you can do in legacy code. And so you get this very high coverage really quickly, and you have to make sure that you're actually testing what comes out of it. So remember that code coverage just means your code has been run. It doesn't necessarily mean it's been verified. So another thing I'll do is I will change something maliciously around where I'm going to work and make sure that my tests actually fail to make sure that not only is it being executed, but the result of this is being tested. But again, this is one of the advantages that approval test, you know, the bigger that log file is or the bigger the output is, the more likely you're going to have not just executing lines, but verified lines.
Hmm. Okay. I think I'm kind of running out of questions here. Kevin, did you have anything else?
I don't think so.
Okay. Kay Scott?
No, this has been good. I want to try this out tomorrow.
Yeah, fantastic. This is really, you know, I mean, I think the way that you showed it off in your talk, refactoring legacy code, because it's easy enough to start from scratch with, you know, okay, I'm right. When you're doing test driven from the start, it's you've got coverage, you're doing a little bit of time.
Life is easier.
Exactly, but slapping testing onto legacy code is where it just kind of all falls apart at some points. And so this is exactly like you're saying. If you can verify, hey, does everything work as it is now? Are you happy with the output of this, and whether it's visual or textual or whatever, you verify the output, and then you can refactor, which is one of the huge benefits of you know, testing, is that you can refactor without fear. And this gives you that with legacy code as well. And also, I mean, we've talked about, I mean, I've been thinking in my head .NET the whole time, but it's great that you can do this in Java and Ruby and, you know, eventually JavaScript maybe, and, you know, I mean, PHP.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, wherever you're in, and unfortunately, legacy code will take you to all sorts of different places. I'm sure at one point I'll be forced to write a C++ version of this, but I'm dreading that day.
Cool. I wanted to ask about teaching kids programming. I wanted to make sure.
Oh, yes.
Are we done talking about approval tests then? Anything else?
I think we're good.
Great. So teaching kids programming is really cool. I've got three daughters, and one's 10 years old, and I want to, you know, I've kind of made half-hearted attempts at teaching her programming over the years, and I really want to kind of take it more seriously now. How did you get involved in teaching kids programming?
So, again, I pair on everything that I do. And I got in an argument at a local after-school program as to whether or not you can teach kids in a test-driven manner. And somehow out of that argument, I ended up being volunteered for a class. and so I started doing that. And then I met Lynn Langett, who's an evangelist from Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And she was doing this stuff with this program called DigiGirls, which is all about getting girls into tech because, you know, there's not a skill issue with girls in tech, but there definitely is a cultural issue. And after a while of that cultural issue, it becomes a skill issue because, you know, there's natural talent, but there's also just, you know, there's a lot of learning involved in technical work.
Right. It's an unfair thing for a college age girl to say, I'm going to jump into tech out of the blue because
they've
been pushed into it since they were young in a lot of cases.
Well, in Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, he shows that like in Canada, what month you're born at affects your ability to be a hockey star because if you are, you know, when you're five, being a year younger, the people who are grouped together with like who are four and the people who are five, like that's such a big difference. And by the time they become like 14 or 15, where it's not such a big difference, the people who are born earlier in the year have had so much preferential training that they are just better than the people who are younger. So if being born a couple months later and yet being going to the same teams, you know, your entire life makes you less likely to be a pro hockey star. Think of the disadvantage that occurs if you spend your life being told that girls don't do math or girls don't do computers. And at 22, you decide you want to change that. I mean, like, it's mm-hmm. way late in the game to come in. And while it's possible, it requires a lot more force of will and talent. There's lots of very talented people who literally just get shunted out, usually around, you know, sort of 10 and so, because culture is just sort of pushing them as, hey, this isn't an area for you. And so DigiGirls really kind of tries to combat that and give a lot of both fun things with tech, but also more importantly, I think, a lot of role models to say, hey, you know, we are women, we're young women. And so obviously I can't, I'm not good at presenting like that, but what I am good at is the courseware. And I saw what she was doing, and she did this thing with a turtle, which is, you know, logo, and where it did a for loop, and I saw it being animated, and I had just gotten the class I was teaching to understand the for loop by getting them through a debugger and seeing how I changed. And that's when the light sort of went on, and I saw these people, the light go on that for loop right in like the first hour of them mm-hmm. learning to program. And I just thought, oh my God, this is brilliant. I want to do something with this. And we started working together, and within 2 or 3 months had taught 4 classes, you know, from here to Denmark. And, you know, a year later, we've done about 75, 80 classes across the world. We've trained a lot of other teachers. We've created a lot of courseware. It's just really a fun project to do, and it's really rewarding. And it's just great to see, you know, kids get introduced to something that you love, and that you get to see them love it too. It's fantastic.
So what's the courseware in? What are you teaching them?
Well, we actually have the courseware in 2 things. We have it in Java, because originally at the time I was teaching Java. Mm-hmm. But most of it is in Microsoft Small Basic, which is actually technically a .NET language. It compiles into .NET 3.5. And we have extensions on it. And we have about, I don't know, 14, 15 one-hour classes. Now, we have stuff like the Coens, like I mentioned, for RX, for the kids. Mm-hmm. We call it homework because it's less fancy and Zen-ish. but it's code with blanks in it that will run, and they have to keep doing it to get stuff to pass. We have recipes, which is a bunch of code, well commented, and then the code is deleted. So you get the comments in English, and they have to take that intention and turn it into code. And that's really the start of our things. We have quizzes, which again are their code and test. And so each method you do that does it passes. And it's just really helpful to know, like, hey, I just did this recipe. Have I really learned anything? We want to keep that stuff tight together. And then we have something called variations, where they get to basically hack and play. So you usually write the recipe, then you do variations where you hack it and play with it. Then you do a quiz to verify that you've learned something. And then you do some homework to sort of richen and deepen. We have about 14 of those lessons put together. They're all free, free as in beer, free as in freedom, except for Small Basic is owned by Microsoft. We don't have control of that. But the extensions, all the courseware, all that stuff. We have SQL classes. One of the favorites of that is we have a boyfriend database where high school girls will query for for Hot Boys for an hour, and they love it, and they're just so happy, and they're learning SQL. I mean, you're to be a high school girl enjoying writing T-SQL in the editor, that's great. Like, you see that, and you're like, yeah, this is, you know, that's that joy of, you know, we're augmenting it a little bit, but it's great to see the power that you can do, and to see them start to get that. It's just really, really satisfying. And, you know, I recently have a stepdaughter, and I've done a lot of teaching other kids around the world, and it's great, and I like it, but, you know, she just got her math scores back, and they were so much higher, and like, that's if all the other people I taught all of a sudden forgot stuff, I'd be totally fine with it, because she learned it. And so I really encourage, you know, with your daughters and other listeners out there who have kids of their own, you know, go and teach your kids the stuff, because A, it's just so rewarding when your kids learn. It's more rewarding than anything else that you can do, you know, in kind of volunteer work. And then also, it's great when they get an appreciation of what you do in a day-to-day. That's also really fantastic. So,
yeah. You know. So where do our listeners find out more about this is DigiGirls? Is that
correct? So DigiGirls is where Lynn started. We've actually moved everything to teachingkidprogramming.org. That's teachingkidsprogramming.org.
Okay.
And all of it's on there, all the lessons. There's lots of videos for teachers to see how to do it, all the courseware, everything.
Awesome. And then when I was looking earlier at the it looked like the courseware starts at or the classes at least start at 13 years old. Is that correct?
So the rule for classes is that you have to be able to type. Usually for us, we start teaching at 10.
Oh.
But that's slightly dependent by country. In America, though, 10. And I would suggest that for the listeners, their kids probably know how to type pretty well at 7 or 8.
Okay.
They tend to be in a much more technical situation.
Very cool. So on the Teaching Kids Programming site, I'm having trouble finding where, like, upcoming, are there events in the, you mentioned events earlier, are there upcoming events?
There's lots of events. We do not put those on the Teaching Kid Programming site. We train teachers, we give events ourselves.
Okay.
We usually do not do open enrollment events, which is why they're not on there.
Okay.
But we do teach, if you want your kids to learn, the short answer is you're going to have to teach them yourself. We highly suggest that you partner with like a local school or a Cub Scouts or something like that if you want to put on an event, because they're not teaching this in schools,
mm-hmm.
right? And people who are good at computers, who have mathematical thinking abilities, the salary of computers is just so, it's 6 to 8 times higher than it is for a school teacher. I mean, you have to be very, you know, okay with poverty to not do that. And so you're not getting a lot of people staying in schools, and so they're not teaching programming in your school. The few schools that have anything related to computers are usually teaching how to use computers, stuff like Word, right. Photoshop, that kind of thing.
How to be an information worker.
Yes.
But not how to be...
not how to create. Exactly.
Yep.
So it's really, unfortunately, it's on your shoulders. But equally fortunately, you know, we're all well equipped to teach kids, and especially our own kids.
Mm-hmm.
So... and take the courseware and just sit down with them a little bit and start going.
Very cool. And while we're talking about it, I just want to mention an earlier show. We talked to Sarah Chips on our Herding Code 90, episode 90, and we talked about her Girl Develop It, which is for women that want to learn how to program. So that's a cool program out there as well.
Nice. I love to see more programmers, love to see more women programmers.
Like, yep.
All around, that's something that I feel very strongly about having more of.
Very cool. Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention? Anything? Any upcoming speaking engagements or anything you'd like to?
Well, there's quite a lot of upcoming speaking engagements. There's we're going to be speaking at the National Teachers Convention on the Teaching Kids Programming stuff and speaking in at Agile 2011. One of the things for .NET people, you know, this is obviously a show about testing. There's a lot of very interesting stuff occurring in the Agile world that is very directly related to the .NET world. But unfortunately, I don't see a lot, you know, so I speak at TechEds and stuff, and I also speak at Agile, and there's very little cross-pollination. I'd highly suggest, you know, go out and talk to more people, because there's really interesting things in both places would, you know, again, I've learned so much from pairing and collaboration, and too often I see people in .NET not collaborating, and it's really a shame, because they have a lot to share, and they have a lot to get.
Great. And, you know, that's honestly one of the things that we try and do with this podcast is try and kind of cross-pollinate as much as possible. And that's why, you know, we've been bringing on people. I mean, we bring on people that we're interested in speaking to, but also we do try and cross-pollinate into the .NET world. So this Agile 2011 that you're speaking at, that's in Salt Lake City, August 8th through 12th. Is that correct?
Yes.
Awesome. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Llewellyn. This was really cool.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And that's all the time we have this week on Herding Code. We'll talk to you next time.